Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Chapter 1 of a textbook called Physics by Hecht. It's perhaps one of the best textbooks I've ever read in terms of the overall structure and meticulous way it's been put together. So I'm just going to read it, part of my cardiac rehabilitation, forgive me for clearing my throat. An introduction to physics. Physics is the study of the physical universe, and though we all know what the word physical universe refers to, it would take volumes to attempt to explain what they really mean. The problem is that the basic underlying concepts, matter, space, and time, are difficult, if not impossible, to define conceptually, a shortcoming we share with the philosophers. All the material things we are familiar with, from stars to toenails, are structures composed of ever smaller structures, ultimately the smallest indivisible subatomic grains of matter are the fundamental real particles, which compose compose all that exists. The primary property of matter is that it is observable. It interacts in ways that results in changes we can detect. Physics, then, is the study of matter, interaction, and change. Obviously, even during the publication of this book, there you have dark matter. And look, there's a few comments I have to do. It's just this book obviously believes in particles, whereas I, as a quantum physicist, believe particles as waves. Physicists try to describe phenomena in the simplest, most precise way, an approach that leads to a language of exact terminology. There are, for instance, concepts in physics that correspond to basic properties of matter, such as mass, charge, momentum, and energy, that describe the location of matter in space and time, such as displacement, velocity, and acceleration, and that pertain to the behavior of matter in bulk, heat, current, resistance, and pressure. All of these concepts have very specific scientific meanings. So just to re-summarize there, there's the mass and charge, displacement and velocity, heat and current. That is what the individual things are, what they're doing, and what they're doing in bulk. In addition to the conceptual or dictionary-like definitions, physicists rely on operational definitions to augment the working language of their discipline. These definitions are procedural and include actual things, a standard mass, a thermometer, a stream of cesium atoms, and so on. Operational definitions demarcate a quantity by telling how to measure it. For example, a second is an interval of time corresponding to exactly 9,192,631,770 oscillations of cesium-133 atom. Not being able to conceptually define time is completely satisfactory way. Doesn't prevent us from thinking about it, or being able to measure it, or even from growing old. Sort of nice action there. So what they're saying is that even though we don't have the time, we have a set of procedures which actually, even though we don't understand the concept, we refer to it, time, as what you get from a specific set of procedures. Beautifully put, very clearly thought. The natural sciences, as distinct from social sciences, have nature as their subject, that is, material phenomena. Physics, the premier natural science, deals with atoms, deals with composition, structure, shape, creation, annihilation, motion, light, sound, atoms and molecules, fission, fusion, solids and liquids and gases, with the whole of things physical. In purview, it is all that can be observed, all that can be measured. Okay, well, I'd say a little bit beyond that, but Section 1.1, that was the introductory section. The aim of physics is to understand the natural events that we are party to understand the universe, what it is, how it works, what it is doing, and maybe even why it exists. If that bold agenda is possible at all, it's only because natural phenomena occur in reproducible ways. There are rules and rhythms in the seeming chaos. Doing the physics usually involves a record of phenomena, observations, and the collection of data. Information objectively perceived. Okay, I have a slight different view of, you know, what data and information is. So you have measurements, and when measurements are located within basically a table which links the data to a particular piece of information, a particular other pieces of data, when the information is linked in a way, I call it data. Okay, an event observed either deliberately or not, and things are recorded, measured, how much, how long, how many, how big. Physical quantities, it associates numbers with its concepts. Okay, so that's what physical quantities are. Yes, yeah, so I'd say a little bit more about data being actually linked. So 5 degrees is a concept, a potential, but a day, a particular time of day in a particular location being 5 degrees, that's a piece of data. With the body of observations, patterns are sought and reveal relationships amongst the data. A law is a description of a relationship in nature that manifests itself in recurring patterns and events. It can be a prescription of how things change, or it might be a statement of how things remain invariant to change. And this is an important thing, that for some reason people say that laws are a proven theory. Well, no, not necessarily. You can actually, a law is basically a description found in nature. So you can or cannot break a law. So this is interesting. It varies with the, this is a more correct explanation than it is taught us in our, currently in our schools. How does our basic underlying knowledge, our worldviews of space and time, of matter interacting with matter, account for the patterns of events? How can we understand what is observed? Theory is an explanation of phenomena in terms of more basic natural processes and relationships. To explain phenomena, we draw on intuition and imagination and guess what is happening. We propose hypotheses that leap beyond what we know to what might be. A construct of definitions, hypotheses, and laws that explain some of the observed order in nature is the essence of theory. A powerful theory allows us to deduce already known laws, as well as predict new occurrences and relationships that once tested and confirmed may become new laws. All theories are tentative. The formalism of physics cannot be proven absolutely true or even absolutely false. Our current worldview may be wrong, and all the proofs based on equally wrong. Our hypothesis may be an error. Our laws may only be approximate. Newtonian mechanics works incredibly well for 200 years before it began to deviate even slightly from the most refined observations. Then Albert Einstein proved that the world view on which it was being based was wrong. Newtonian mechanics is a brilliant approximation of a more complete truth. Physics must be continuously tested against nature. Our ideas must correspond in every detail to the observed workings of the universe. But even that does not prove them to be true. The testing never ends. The process goes on, checked and rechecked. Predictions, confirmations, discrepancies, refinement, new visions, new laws, new theories, ever more powerful understanding. At this moment, there is no single significant theory in physics that can be said to be both finished and completely satisfactory. Well, I would disagree. I'd say quantum mechanics is such a theory. We have a magnificent understanding, but it's only the beginning. The game is wonderfully wide open for real surprise, as Einstein suggested, is that we can do so much and know so little. Real surprise, it's Einstein. Okay, look, I want to really make a point here that there is there's a fundamental teaching errors in terms of that laws are just descriptions, theories are explanations based on more basic principles. We don't tend to teach that. And we tend to, there's this real errant thing is a hypothesis is a prediction with a theory attached to it. And so the hypothesis, proving the hypothesis proves the particular theory. That's really poor thinking and really poor teaching. That's really, I don't know, that's ruining generations of future scientists, teaching them that way. Here's a quote from Albert Einstein before we get on to 1.2, the modern perspective. And from Einstein, insofar as propositions of mathematics refer to reality as they are not certain, and insofar as they are certain, they do not refer to reality. Beautiful view of it. Again, yeah, I'd say, yeah, it's a bit strange. If you go into the basic quarks, quantum chromodynamics, Feynman diagrams, it's interesting to see how that goes. 1.2, the next section, 1.2, the modern perspective. Physics has evolved to its present state as a result of 250 years of effort. Simple early theories were displaced by increasingly more effective later ones, and these, in turn, were subsumed by still more powerful, far-reaching, and more complex contemporary treatments. A theory that has functioned well is assumed to possess some measure of truth, and so each new formulation must encompass the wisdom of its predecessors. Okay, so that's beautiful. This is beautifully put together, this textbook so far. Classical physics. The discipline, as it developed up until 1920, is known as classical physics. The classical period rests on three theoretical pillars: Newtonian mechanics, electromagnetic theory, and thermodynamics. Within its boundaries are also several sub-disciplines such as acoustics, wave motion, condensed matter physics, and so on. The completion of classical physics was accomplished by Einstein. His special theory of special relativity, 1905, formulates our conception of space, time, and motion. His general theory of relativity, 1915, considers gravity in terms of curved space-time. It subsumes the special theory and transcends Newton's theory of gravitation. The general theory describes things on a grand scale, allowing us to begin to comprehend such cosmic phenomena as gravitational lenses, black holes, pulses, Big Bang, creation of the universe, and of course, they couldn't even guess it now, the detection of gravitational waves. I remember speaking to people at the time of the publication of this book, they couldn't believe what we've done. Classical physics produced a wonderful but limited picture of the physical world. Indeed, humanity was able to set foot on the moon in 1969 thanks largely to Newton's theory. Except for electronics, which would never have existed without the modern knowledge, the journey to the moon was a classical trip. The moon was really done with valves, there's very little silicon. Classical physics represents the basic conceptual material that should be understood if one interacts, if one is to interact effectively with the physical environment on the everyday macroscopic level. Oh, I should really say that. Philosophically, classical physics is deterministic. It maintains that things can be known with certainty, that immutable laws constrain nature to unfold in a totally predictable way. The cosmos is thus viewed as a great machine that grinds along according to intricate internal order. Once the order is known, we can, in principle at least, compute both the future and the past. Physicists were supremely confident throughout the last decades of the 1800s. As an era dominated by breakthroughs in early experimental atomic physics, everyone expected to successfully apply established theory to the atom. Surprisingly, as time went by, the atomic domain seemed to become more and more inaccessible to classical analysis. I suppose one of the things that unpinned from classical analysis was classical analysis has matrices, has the Hamiltonians, and whether chaos is a classical theory. So it's One of the things which is non-deterministic in classical world is chaos. So just a talk in there. Here's a quote from Louis de Broglie. Light is, in short, the most refined form of matter. Whoa, that shows that person was really not that bright. My godfather. Okay. Modern physics. The reality of the atom was finally established only at the beginning of the 20th century, in large measure due to the work of Einstein. Moreover, in direct conflict with classical theory, Einstein showed that light was emitted and absorbed in miniature blasts or quanta. Yeah, it's not, it's right, quanta, that's good, miniature blasts. Oh, I don't perhaps like that. It's a quanta is a box of probability. Okay, these particles of light, the most tenuous form of matter, are called photons. Okay, I wouldn't... Well, I don't know. Is photon matter? Okay. Today, the material universe is considered to be composed of myriads of identical clones of a handful of elementary particles, the quarks, leptons, and photons. All of us basically organize clouds of quarks surrounded by leptons, absorbing and emitting photons. Okay, look... I just have to really wrestle with my head whether a photon is in fact matter, because that's light and light is energy, so the light energy equivalence. Contemporary physics has extended its domain from the subnuclear to an entire universe. Though it seems presumptuous, Genesis has become a branch of modern physics. Particle accelerators can replicate conditions that existed in the first moments of creation. All of this and more are the fruits of quantum mechanics. We now know the physical process, although they appear to be continuous on a macroscopic level, are fundamentally discrete. These entities of the micro world exist and move in ways that are distinctly restricted. The continuum of motion is an illusion. Change occurs in jumps. The landscape is quantized. Yeah, I think there's a fundamental misconception here. I'd say there's a fundamental misconception here that they actually think that space... Oh, space has got pixel size. It's not necessarily moving. Okay. Philosophically, I mean, because energy is not quantized, so the photon is not... It's quantized in terms of angular momentum. It's energy... is given off in quanta, but that it's more involved in holography and that type of thing. Philosophically, it can be argued that quantum mechanics embraces determinism, but it is certainly not the all-knowing determinism of classical physics. The universe has maybe a great machine, but its tiniest parts are mysteriously elusive. We cannot possibly know everything we would like to know. There are soft edges to certainty, and the future has yet to be written. Despite its baffling text, the strange version of reality, quantum mechanics has never once failed an experimental text. Yay, quantum mechanics! Is extremely reliable and not transparently comprehensible. Well, if you set off with this path, you won't going to understand it. It's likely truth that no one understands quantum mechanics, although... It's equally true that some wonderful way quantum mechanics understands the universe. Beautiful, beautiful prose, but I don't like the idea that that motion is quantized. God, I don't know what's going on. The four forces, matter, whatever it is. Is a photon matter? That's an interesting thing. I'm going to go away and research that one. Photon is matter. I think I can work with that one. Matter, whatever it is, interacts. The universe is laced with a web of interactions that evolved since the moment of creation. Contemporary theoretical physics maintains that the world as it exists today, there are four distinct basic interactions, the forces of gravitational, electromagnetic, strong and weak. The influence of the entire range of observable occurrences. Okay, I just have to get in my head what the electroweak is. Okay, I'll have to go back and, yep, Okay. I have to really go back and research it. This is why I'm reading these books, just to a click in my head, because I have read other articles linking electromagnetic and the weak force, and the forces actually all eventually should go back to one force. When a change in the state of something occurs, we assume a cause or logically presume that the change is effectuated by a force. When an apple falls for a grasshopper leaves, a supernova explodes, a Newton decays, there are very different events that unfold because of the involvement of the four forces. Thus, we define force broadly as an agent of change. That is actually correct. That's the what a force is. It's an agent of change, but we observe a change and we infer a force, but forces actually don't really exist. The gravitational force keeps you, the atmosphere, the seas fixed to the surface of the planet. Though gravity is the weakest of all interactions, it's also the least selective. It acts on all particles because its range is unlimited, and because it's only attractive, gravity rules the cosmos in a grand scale, and it holds the Earth in orbit around the Sun. It keeps the Sun locked within our galaxy of hundreds of thousands of millions of stars, or trillions of stars. So that's trillion, it's thousands of thousands of stars, and reaches all across the universe. If it were much stronger than it is, it would quickly halt the present expansion of the universe and send us all the galaxies collapsing back down into oblivion. It may even be even strong enough as it is to inevitably do that anyway. I think that's out of date now. The electromagnetic force binds together smaller things such as atoms, molecules, trees, buildings, and you. As with the gravitational force, it can perceive its consequences directly in the macro world, just as you hold two magnets near one another. The electromagnetic force, acting on a microscopic level, is responsible for a variety of seemingly different macroscopic forces. It produces contact forces. Yeah, this is one of the things that really breaks my teeth, because we now in HSC have to teach contact force and field forces. It produces contact forces, as for example between a fist and a punching bag, or a hamburger and teeth. It generates friction and drags, produces adhesion, cohesion, and is responsible for elastic force. The range of the electromagnetic force is also unlimited, but it can either be attractive or repulsive, and that fact inhibits its influence over great distances. Electromagnetism governs chemistry and biology, rules life and death, and keeps the Earth and everything on it from being crushed by gravity. Yeah, this is this. Yeah, this is. He's referring to the Pauli exclusion principle, limiting the compressibility of atoms. I suppose that's an electromagnetic force. It has to be. The strong force binds quarks together in the form of neutrons and protons, and binds these together in the form of nuclei and atom. It's extremely powerful and exceedingly short range, whose influence extends about as far as the diameter of a proton. Its tiny range now, its tiny range, whose influence extends. Okay, its tiny range accounts for it not obtruding directly into the normal experience, and as a result, not being discovered until this century, or last century. Without it, familiar matter and planets, from planets to puppies, would all disintegrate into a finite quark dust. All the quarks would supposedly fly around. Now, again, the short range is not due to the gluons having mass. Gluons don't have mass. Gluons form, I think, flux tubes. This is just going off my head. Flux tubes, and the flux tubes have a huge amount of energy about it. It's a different form rather than mass. The weak force is a million times fainter than the strong force and 100 times shorter in range. Among other things, it transforms one flavor or type of quark into another. Thus, it can change protons into neutrons, and thereby responsible for the slow decay of certain radioactive atoms, such as uranium. It's an interesting thing, yeah. A star like the Sun derives its energy from thermonuclear furnace in its core. There, it burns hydrogen into helium and produces a process that relies on the gradual transformation of protons via the weak force. Hence, no weak force, no sunshine, no life on earth. That's an interesting fact. Most physicists believe the four forces are quantized and do not act as continuous streamers of individual tentacles extending from one interacting body to another. Instead, I mean, the Feynman diagrams where the Most physicists believe the four forces are quantized. They are quantized in terms of the angle of the... like a photon is the carrier of the electromagnetic force, but it's got a quantization of angular momentum. That's really weird. Instead, forces are caused by the back and forth exchange of special class of force mediating particles. These virtual particles only exist as transmitters of force and cannot otherwise be observed. This line of thinking has been quite successful, though it remains tantalizingly incomplete and problematically, philosophically problematic. Okay, well, a photon can't be observed because a photon's light. I don't know how this is a really good book, but it really needs to be fixed. For the moment, the greatest impasse experienced by contemporary physics involves the inability to bring into harmony two fundamental theories, general relativity, primarily its vision of gravity, and quantum mechanics. Relativity is an overview grounded in the analysis of space-time. All theories should be relativistically correct. Quantum mechanics is an overview grounded in the analysis of energy and momentum. That's correct. In a way, change occurs. All theory should be quantum mechanically correct. As yet, there are no satisfactory blending of the two. There is no adequate quantum theory of gravity. If researchers succeed, they'll be able to be on the road to brashly calling the theory of everything. Well, it's really interesting to see about the recent discovery of the Higgs boson. Here's interesting, this is a real era thing, and it's all true what they're saying here. Symmetry. Physics is in the last quarter of this century has become to a remarkable revelation. On a fundamental level, nature possesses a range of symmetries that are associated with more basic laws of physics. By understanding these symmetries, we can produce theories that presumably have the correct internal logical structure. Physicists now believe that for a basic theoretical construct to be right, it must have a subtle mathematical form called gauge symmetry. Well, you've got the gauge bosons. Such an incredible statement could not have been made 100 years ago, nor could scientists have uttered it with much assurance even 3 or 4 decades back. Our confidence derives from an amazing series of discoveries that accumulated in 1983. Gauge symmetry was introduced as an abstract mathematical idea in the 1950s. By the mid-60s, theoreticians were attempting to use it to produce the theory of the weak force. Gradually, the work began to suggest that the weak force and the electromagnetic interactions were actually two aspects of the same phenomenon. Okay, that's what I had before. The treatment predicted the existence of three extraordinarily massively new particles. Although experiments in the 1970s confirmed a series of other predictions based on the theory, no laboratory in the world had the equipment powerful enough to create a trio of hypothetical particles. When the feat was finally accomplished, a new generation of colliding beam machines in 1983, three particles created were found to have exactly the charges and most exactly the mass predicted. Gauge symmetry was firmly established. We discuss the symmetries and trace the development of these profound ideas through this text. Now, this is one of the great things, is that reading these books from these times, you get to really understand the steps going forward. Noether's principle. There are many kinds of symmetries, the simplest of which are geometrical. Imagine a perfectly uniform disc mounted on a central axis. Suppose you close your eyes and someone rotates the disc. When you open the eyes, everything is as it was before. You can't tell that anything has occurred. when a change in a physical system leaves the same aspect of the system unchanged, the system possesses a corresponding symmetry. The existence of symmetry means that the feature of the system is changeless or invariant. For instance, we say that a disk possesses rotational symmetry, so that the system is invariant under rotation about a central axis. The amount of rotation can be varied smoothly, and the symmetry is said to be continuous. The letter S is invariant under rotation of 180 degrees, just as a snowflake is invariant under 60 degrees. That's interesting because this is doing S2 symmetry, really great. In contrast, the letter A is symmetric under a Miller reflection on the vertical center line. That kind of symmetry is discontinuous, that is, it jumps all or nothing. There are all geometrical symmetries that we can appreciate by just looking at them, but on a deeper level, any invariance suggests a symmetry. In nature, there are important invariances associated with more subtle symmetries. The first person to grasp the physical implication of this was Émile Noether. Among the central conceptual pillars of classical physics, there are three conservation laws, the powerful insights that took hundreds of years to develop: conservation of linear momentum, conservation of angular momentum, and conservation of energy. Each maintains that a specific quantity is constant at every moment in an isolated system, undergoes change. Noether's principle states that for every continuous symmetry, there is a corresponding conservation law, and vice versa. In due course, we will learn how each of the great conservation laws turns out to be a direct consequence of a specific symmetry of space and time. Noether's principle is more general yet. It also applies to subtler abstract symmetries such as gauge symmetry. In chapter 18, we see how this principle relates to conservation of electromagnetic charge. That will be interesting. I wouldn't mind going back on that one. Now, suppose we paint a disc half red and half green. If the viewers happen to be colorblind, nothing is altered. But if they are not, symmetry is radically reduced. It's broken. In nature, symmetries are often spontaneously broken. Imagine a perfectly symmetrical ballpoint pen placed on its tip. We might suppose that if it were no vibration, no winds, other external influences, the pen would remain upright indefinitely. But that's not likely. You know, for quantum mechanics, that things on an atomic level are always changing. The symmetry will be spontaneously break and the pen will fall. Okay, that's... again, if you put... that's one of the consequences of the Copenhagen school, but of that, for quantum mechanics. And symmetry breaking is slightly different with the Higgs boson. I'll have to really look into it. In an analogous way, many physicists believe that wildly energetic, incredibly dense, infinite universe was a place of great symmetry, an undifferentiated simplicity. In the early universe, was ruled by a single superforce that ultimately broke into four forces, and the universe cooled, calmed, and shattered into complexity. Yeah, well, it is interesting in terms of that we are linear translation invariant, but rotation, there's an absolute zero rotation in the universe. Measurement. Physics is founded on experimentation. We ground the science directly to nature through the observation that entails the measurement of physical quantities. The basic notions of length, volume, and weight, and time were quantified in antiquity and simply carried over into physics. Today, the scientific community follows the SI, System International, a program in which the majority of measurements are based on the following units of length, the meter, mass, the kilogram, and seconds, electric current, the ampere, and temperature, Kelvin. Okay, it'll be interesting because a lot of this would be out of date by now. The length is the distance or extent in space, whatever distance is, or for that matter, whatever space is. Given the limitations of language, it's easier to measure length precisely than talk about it precisely. Stick your arm out and announce that the distance from the elbow to the farthest outstretched fingertip is the length to be known as a cubit. That's the way it was done for 4,000 years ago in Egypt and Mesopotamia. The agreed upon measure by which we can reckon the physical quantity is called a unit. It's beautiful. The Great Pyramids were built to cubic specifications, as was Noah's Ark. Of course, you can't build a large structure if everyone's forearm is different. An advanced society must evolve an unchanging embodiment of each unit to serve as a primary reference or standard. The black granite master cubit was just such standard against which the cubic sticks of Egypt were regularly checked. For centuries, primitive body measures were used throughout Europe, and the width of a man's thumb was an inch. The length of a sandal was a foot. The rise of modern science painfully exposed the lack of universality of a standardized system. In 1790, Thomas Jefferson proposed a decimal scheme for weights and measures, but the US Congress would have nothing to do with it. At the same time in France, the climate of revolution was ripe for innovation. The French adopted a decimal approach for their metric system, dividing all quantities into 10, 100, 1,000, and so on, equal parts. The French decided on a new unit of length, the meter, or meter, that's the way we spell it, M-E-T-R-E, for the Greek metron, or measure, abbreviated to M, small m. It's 1/10 millionth of the distance from the North Pole to the equator, along the median line passing through Paris. However, patriotic errors in the difficult measurement made the whole exercise quite arbitrary. They would have just as well stayed home and used the length of Napoleon's sword instead. Be that as it may, the distance between the two lines described on a bar of platinum iridium became, in 1889, the world's standard meter. So that's when... Okay, now we've changed there what the standard meter is. The metric system is the base, so the meter is how far light travels in 1 second. And it's so many wavelengths of cesium light. Okay. The metric system, which is the basis of SI, gradually spread across Europe, although it was shunned by the British for over a century. The United States, in happy distance oblivion, continued to use the dreadful British system and is still trying to make its transition. The system used in the United States is called US Customary Units. It is based on length, weight, and time expressed in feet and pounds and seconds, respectively. Because a billion in the United States is 1,000 times smaller than the European billion, okay, I think what's happened now is that everyone has just gone with the US billion. The common names for numbers beyond a million are rarely expressed, used in scientific work. Instead, prefixes are added to the units. Greek prefixes, like kilo, mega, giga, and multiples, are multiples. The Latin ones, like centi, milli, and micro, are subdivisions. Well, that's all right. Latin is a sub, and Greek is for larger. That's interesting. I didn't know that. A related approach that is used, especially where things are a small scale, such as CGS, centimeter gram second systems. Here, a centimeter is 1/100th part of a meter. An inch is defined as exactly 2.54 centimeters, so the inch system is actually linked into the metric system. A centimeter, gram, and second SI units, but all other in CGS system, the units of force, pressure, and density are not. Okay, well, I don't think anyone uses CGS anymore. That's my thing. 29 duplicates of the international prototype meter were made, and major industrial nations still preserve copies. The United States maintains number 27. Oh, after the Nazis conquered France, it became obvious that the world's reliance on a single vulnerable standard was foolhardy. Far better to redefine the meter in terms of some measurement that could be performed any well-equipped laboratory. In 1916, the System International accepted that the meter became... this is out of date. I won't read that to you. That's now... Oh, okay. It's 1,650,763.73 wavelengths of orange, red, krypton, argon, lamp. In the decades followed with the advent of stable lasers, the speed of light was measured with extraordinary precision. In 1983, the decision was made to use the basis redefined would be better times 10 times more precise... Speed of light vacuum is now defined. I like that. It's now defined. The speed of light is still defined this way as 299792483 meters per second. You know, a fraction under 3 × 10⁸ meters per second, which is the best measured value. The meter is then the distance of light travelled in a vacuum in exactly that of a second. This new standard will never need to be revised. Improvement in the measuring time will simply improve the measurement of the meter. Okay. This is interesting. It's getting out of date here. 1.4, mass and weight. The French set out to construct a metric system. They followed the ancient Babylonian example of defining weights in terms of the fixed volume of water. The original gram, which is the original unit of weight, was specified as the absolute weight of a volume of pure water equals the size of a cube, 1/100th of a meter, that is a cube 1 centimeter on a side. Historically, the weight was the downward force acting on an object at the surface of the earth. It was generally assumed to be constant. In fact, the weight was of an object varies in location was discovered inadvertently in 1671 by J. Richter, who found his pendulum clock, when brought from Europe to French Guiana, ran close to losing 2.5 minutes each day. Well, this is really good. I knew that. In fact, I probably knew that from reading this textbook many years ago, and then followed up. Newton promptly explained the surprising effect by clearly distinguishing between weight and mass, two ideas which have been around for centuries. Well, reading the Latin, I suppose he did. Well, okay. Mass is properly as a property of a sample of matter immersed in the universe as large. It apparently is independent of the local distribution of matter, and it's constant everywhere on Earth. Indeed, a mass of an object in a laboratory will be measured to be constant no matter where in the universe the laboratory is. Masses interact gravitationally and cause the force we call weight. What gives rise to mass is still an unsettled issue. Well, it is pretty settled now, my friend. Weight of an object at the surface of a planet is due to the gravitational interaction between objects of the Earth. Speaking practically, weight arises out of our local gravitational interaction between the sample of a massive object and its immediate vicinity, such as the planet, moon, or asteroid. At far distances from all objects, the weight of a sample effectively vanishes. Mass never vanishes. Richter's pendulum bob, its mass constant, was moved to a place of gravity was reduced, and consequently the weight is reduced. Thus the pendulum was pulled down on each swing with less force and swung more slowly. Well, I'd really like to go through the mass definition here, to go historically back. I wonder if they cover this. Ultimately, physicists properly sees considering weight to be a fundamental property of matter. And in 1889... the kilogram was redefined as a unit of mass. Thank bloody goodness. That is interesting that it took that long to go. The standard kilogram is the platinum iridium sitting cylinder watched over by the International Bureau of Weights and Measures. It's a little thing about the size of a whiskey shot glass, 39 millimetres in both height and diameter. By definition, the gram is 1,000th part of a kilogram. Once the international kilogram was agreed upon, the copies were made. A pound balance could then be used anywhere on the planet to compare the mass of one object with the set of standard masses. Since gravity is the same on each pound, if the balance is level, the masses are equal independent of what they might weigh in location. Okay, this has really moved on now because we're about to replace the kilogram with a Planck's constant. 40 nearly identical masses were made in London in 1884. The standard for the United States is kilogram 24, K20. Its clone, kilogram 4, sits next to each other in sealed glass dome in the basement of a vault of the National Institute of Standards, NIST. Kilogram 20 is rarely handled for fear sloth strata of metal may be worn away. Even so, it has travelled to Paris on four occasions in its lifetime of over 100 years. The kilogram is only remaining unit in the SI to be still based on an actual artifact. Well, it's now, we're getting rid of that. Okay, it's taken, 84, taken nearly 30 years to get rid of this thing. Who would have thought it's taken 30 years? The kilogram is the only remaining unit. Exposing the mass to air or touching it or even with tongs can change it. But if it's to be used, it must be handled, however carefully. Although the atomic standard for mass is probably inevitable, the cylinder survives because it's easy to compare objects of the size with the accuracy of several parts per thousand million. Well, it turns out, well, they may still go in the atoms. Sorry about the noise in the background. Because the weight depends on mass, we explore the physics of converting from one to another in Chapter 4. Whenever you buy anything by the gram, kilogram, ounce, the measure must be traceable back through a long list of calibrations to the primary standard. The mass is a fundamental property of matter, and that's what I think you really should have said, that we attempt to define via three seemingly different approaches. It is what participates in gravitational interactions, the measure of opposite resistance to change, and a measure of the quantity of matter possessed in an object. Okay, and there's a fourth fundamental one, which is quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics says that the waveform, the lighter something is, less massive it is, the more, the larger it is. Time. The rhythm of life, the passing of successive days, the pounding of hearts, suggests a progression, a sequencing of occurrence. Time is a measure of the unfolding of events. Space is revealed as the juxtaposition of matter. Time is revealed as the change in juxtaposition. Whatever time is, it can be measured against uniform change. That's actually beautifully put together. That's a beautiful sentence. That's often done with some cyclic phenomena like the rising of the sun. More than 30,000 years ago, yes, this is really good, this book. Ago, the Egyptians divided the day and night into 12 equal hours. Babylonian, so as the day and night varied in a year, you'd have different lengths of hours. Babylonian arithmetic had 60 as its number base and subsequently developed the tradition of subdividing things into 60 parts. It was probably sometime in the 14th century after the arrival of the mechanical clock, the hour got divided into 60 minutes. The word minute is an abbreviation of a medieval Latin for first minute part, which is why the word minute and minute are spelled the same. Minute and minute. I've got an accent over the U. Later, when the so-called second minute part was measured, the natural takes 60 seconds to a minute. As a young pre-med undergraduate in 1582, Galileo noticed a swinging pendulum kept steady beat with beat and suggested it might serve as a measure of time, but he actually used his pulse. Oh, okay, let's see. By early 1600s, astronomers were using pendulums at 39.1 inches long or 99.4 meters pushed every now and then by hand to count out seconds. A tremendous, which happens to be a second, is a pendulum. A tremendous improvement in accuracy was achieved in 1659 when Huygens introduced the pendulum clock, which had an error of only 10 seconds a day. Minute hands, which had been rare, became a rule, and clocks were soon fitted with second hands for the first time. By the 1920s, a free pendulum clock was keeping time to better than 200th of a second. Your 200th of a second day. The day high noon to high noon had been benchmark of time for millennium, but Earth's spin rate is slowing down. The days grow longer. In In 1667, the SI unit of time, the second, was defined is required for, and this is the way we go, 992,631,770 vibrations of the cesium 133 clock measured via the atomic beam clock. At present, such clocks are in error by 1 second. Well, they're billions of years now. Their remarkable consistency is a manifestation of precise quantized energy states of the cesium energy, cesium atom. To calculate modern timekeeping, the atomic clocks at Nis Bohr Colorado have been found, as expected from general relativity, to run 15.5 nanoseconds faster today than those in Paris and in Washington. That is, the gravitational field is weaker. Yeah, is greater. Einstein showed that time depends on gravity. The city of Boulder is 1 mile above sea level. At this altitude, time runs a little faster. Yeah, that's an important point to put forward, my friend. But again, because you've defined time, you can have this, the time is running the same. I don't know. If we ever communicate with extraterrestrial, we surely won't use meters, kilograms, and seconds. They will certainly measure length of mass and time. We should have no trouble making the necessary conversion. Our physics, to an extent, is correct. Must be their physics. And that's what gauge symmetry is all about. That finishes the first half of chapter one. The second half of chapter one will deal with significant figures, graphs, and the methodology of using these physics concepts and units. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.